You're listening to a message from Every Nation GTA. For more information, please visit our website at everynationgta.org.
We are in a series in the book of Hebrews, and so we're calling it The Better Way. And it's a book that was written actually as a sermon. It was a sermon from the time, and it was addressed to a particular group of Christians, young Christians in the first century, and they were really struggling with their faith. A lot of them were Jewish, had been converted to Christianity, but were really feeling the tug to go back, to kind of turn away from Jesus and kind of go back to what they knew, what was safe, what was comfortable. Perhaps they'd been severely persecuted by family, maybe lost their businesses. It was a high cost to follow Jesus in that time. And so this letter, this sermon is written to basically the theme throughout is fix your eyes on Jesus. That's the author, just pointing them constantly back to Jesus. I love that in our worship, we were getting our eyes off ourselves and putting it on Jesus. Not just all the benefits he provides for us, but his beauty. And so I love the spirit of that. And so we want to continue that as we go through the book of Hebrews. And even though we're not first century Jewish Christians and we do live in a very different time, it still speaks to us today in our doubts, our times of testing, our times of struggle with faith, our times of sometimes maybe getting persecuted for your faith, maybe with friends or colleagues or whatever it may be, moments that we might waver in our faith. The message is still the same to us. Let's fix our eyes on Jesus because he is worthy. So we're going to dive in today. We're going to look at how Jesus is the better priest. Have you also got... Okay, awesome. So we're going to read from Hebrews chapter 4. It's a long passage, and so I will read. I see that we might be struggling with the slides today. But Hebrews chapter 4, and then we're going to dip into a little bit into chapter 5. So Hebrews 4 verse 14 from the NIV, it says this. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are. Yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Chapter 5. Every high priest is selected from among the people and is appointed to represent the people in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. This is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins as well as for the sins of the people. And no one takes this honor on himself, but he receives it when called by God, just as Aaron was. In the same way, Christ did not take on himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but God said to him, you are my son, today I become your father. And he says in another place, you're a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Verse 7, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Let's pray and jump in to what we've just read today. Father, we thank you so much that you have truth for us here today, God. You have an encounter for us today, God. That you want us to see the beauty of Jesus, but also see the benefits of what he has done on our behalf. Lord, thank you that your grace meets us where we're at, but it doesn't leave us where we're at. And so we ask that you would do what you want to do in our lives, God, for your glory and our joy. Amen. All right. So the first thing you might be asking when you hear that and read that is the need for a priest. Like, this is archaic language. We're in the 21st century. Why do we even talk about that? Some of you come from a Catholic background. Some of you come from no religious background. But when you think of a priest, you probably think of a priest in a very religious gear performing ceremonies and rituals in a church service, right? It's oftentimes what we go to. One of the central themes in the book of Hebrews is this idea that Jesus is not just a priest, but he's the great high priest. What on earth does that mean? We'll look at that a little bit today. And how it shows that he is a far better priest than all the priests that came before him. So, when you think of priests, maybe your mind goes to that. When I think of priests, I think of something very local here in our city. The Burgers priest. It's what I think of. Now, I wonder if you didn't have breakfast, you might be like, has anyone dined at the Burgers Priest? Okay, there's my people. All right, so if I've never tried an In-N-Out burger, but it's very similar to the California burger because the owner, the previous owner, the person who started this, he's since sold it off to a bigger corporation. But the guy who started this was from California, and then he moved to Toronto. And when he moved to Toronto, he was in seminary. He was a Christian. He was in seminary. And when he was in seminary, I love this. When he was in seminary, he was really struggling with the call of God upon his life. And he felt like God was calling him to business. I love that he's in seminary, and he feels God's calling him to start cook burgers for people. I love that because sometimes we think if we're going to serve God, we have to serve him as a religious priest. But he became the burgers priest. And so you see that redeeming the burger one at a time. And so the name is funny, but if you read his story, he really believed that he wanted to take something as ordinary as food and have it as a way to mediate God's goodness to us. Stand in the gap, if you will. That's what a priest really does. A stand mediates between us and the divine through a meal, through a burger. Now, I think it's changed. I haven't been there in a while, but used to go into Burgers Priests and you would have scriptures. Revelation was on the walls. You'd have very outspoken because he wanted to redefine, I guess, a simple thing like a burger and see it as a way that connects us to an experience way beyond just having a hamburger. That's what a priest does. That's what a mediator does, is they mediate something beyond us, something better, and capture something that's intrinsic to us. We're always looking for something more meaningful. We're always looking for something to mediate a better experience that helps us feel right again, that helps us feel a sense of purpose, that helps us feel justified or whole, whatever it might be that we feel like we're lacking. So now, just as those first century Jewish believers were tempted to rely on old systems of worship and old systems of sacrifice, we too actually face our modern-day priest-like substitutes. Mediators that help us feel better. Mediators that help us deal with things like guilt or shame or a sense of purposelessness. So we understand the role of a mediator. We understand the role of a priest who mediates. Think of a lawyer, right? Think of a lawyer who helps advocate for you when you're guilty or seeking justice. Think of therapists who help us make sense of our own stories, our own pain, and feel heard and redeem those, right? Just like redeeming the burger one at a time. See this religious language that comes out in our day-to-day things. What about musicians or DJs? Now, I was in high school in the last millennium, in the 90s, right? So it feels like the last, when I talk to my kids, like the 90s, my gosh, that's so long. That was like the last millennium, like a lot of you. So there we go. And when I was in the 90s, there was two things happening. There was this massive grunge scene out of Seattle, bands like Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, Nirvana, you might have heard of those, was coming out. And then there was also a massive scene is the dance scene, raves and trance parties and that kind of thing. And it might be very hard for you to believe, but I was once a raver, okay? I was also mixed up in drugs, so that might explain why I was a raver, but I was once a raver. I would go to these parties all night, all weekend long, that kind of thing. But musicians, bands, and DJs, don't they create transcendent experiences for us that connect us to awe and take us beyond ourselves? Doesn't music sometimes do that for you? Isn't there a particular artist or a band or a song or a DJ that mediates a better transcendent-like experience? What about influencers or life coaches? Now, we might disdain them, but they're prevalent everywhere. And what are they trying to do? They're often trying to give us direction or validation or shaping our identity or here's your self-worth or this is the self-talk you need to keep saying to yourself. Well, lastly, what about self-help systems that promise inner peace or transformation through life hacks or self-mastery or willpower? What is the point of all this? Is we have priests every day in our lives. We have mediators that are helping us stand in the gap between us and something on the other side of that, whatever that might be that you're looking for. And so even though this might be religious speak, it's intrinsic to us as human beings in the sense of we're always looking for a better priest. Now, all of those things can actually do something for us. They're not intrinsically bad either, and help us cope with the feeling that something might be broken in our lives or missing in our lives or just not quite right with us or the world. But what the author of Hebrews does, it says, like all of that served a purpose. but points to Jesus, that he has come along now and he trumps all of those things. And so to understand why Jesus is the better priest, let's dive back into our time machine and understand what priests in that particular context were to do. The Jesus, the great high priest. So the word for priest in Latin means bridge builder. So it's another way you might think of it, a mediator or a bridge builder. In any community that's ever had people, they are priests, bridge builders, helping us to intermediaries between two sides. So in Israel, priests had a very similar role. They were bridge builders or stood in the gap between the people and God and the people. So out of the passage we just read, we saw some characteristics of what a high priest was to do and was to be. And so here are some of the characteristics that if you wanted to be a high priest. Number one, you had to be human and chosen by God. Now, human, okay, great, I qualify. You had to be chosen from among the people. You had to be, and there's a reason why that, but you had to be chosen from among the people, but you also had to be chosen by God. And you had to come from a particular lineage, from Aaron's lineage, right? That was the way. So you had to be born into it, if you will, but you also had to be chosen from the people and chosen by God to fulfill that role, particularly the role of the high priest. Secondly, your role was to represent the people before God and atone for their sin. And so there was lots of, have you ever read the Old Testament, ever set out to read the Old Testament, and you get through Genesis, kind of cool, get into Exodus, and then you hit Leviticus? It's like, oh my gosh, this is the worst. That's all those rituals, all those ways and sacrificial systems were really important for a holy God to be with an unholy people. And so that's what these priests were doing, is they were trying to represent, trying to bridge the gap between an unholy people and a holy God who desperately wanted to be with the unholy people, but knew that if he would kill them if they didn't go through some of these rituals because of his holiness. And then he was to deal gently with others because he shares their weakness. He knows what it's like to sin because he himself was a sinner. And so it tells us that before he could make atonement for any of the people's sins, he had to first make atonement for his own sin. And so that's what it was to be a high priest. And then once a year on this day, the Day of Atonement, the high priest, one person out of all the priests, would go into the temple, and the temple had different places, if you will. But in the absolute inner sanctuary of the temple was the most holy place. It was called the Holy of Holies. And only the high priest once a year could go in, and that was where God's manifest presence was. It was kind of like a recreation of Eden, if you will. It's kind of like God's space, heaven on earth, all those different metaphors. And he would go in there and make atonement for the sins of the people, offering them forgiveness. And they would receive forgiveness temporarily, right? Because next year they'd have to do the same thing. But their access to God was still always cut off, limited, right? They couldn't have the manifest presence of God like that person was. And that was the pattern throughout the Old Testament. So we can look at that, and some people have looked at the Old Testament and said, well, now Jesus has come along, the Old Testament was bad, it's wrong. And it wasn't. It's not to say it was bad or was wrong. It's all to say is it was always pointing forward to something better. It was like a signpost, right? Have you ever gone on a road trip? Now, we have GPS these days, but when you didn't have GPS, you would rely on signposts. This is how far you are. You got to turn left here, whatever. Those signposts fulfilled a function. But when you got to the destination, you no longer needed the signposts, right? They fulfilled their function. And so this is what the author of Hebrews is saying, is that that whole system wasn't bad, wasn't wrong, but it was always incomplete. So it was pointing to something better, and the better's come, and his name is Jesus. And so we put our eyes on him now, and he becomes a better priest who gives us greater access to God than those ever did. So let's look at how Jesus is the better priest. Let's look at how he fulfills all these things and more on our behalf. Number one, Jesus is the perfect high priest. Now, the author of Hebrews is going to go on and spend a long time, several chapters, talking about this theme. We don't have the time today, but I want to pull from chapter 7 a little bit. It says, such a high priest truly meets our needs, speaking about Jesus. One who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priest, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. So Jesus, fully human, like us, but unlike us in this one critical area, He was sinless. And so he didn't need to offer sacrifices first for himself and then for the people, because he was the ultimate sacrifice on your and my behalf once and for all. Number two, Jesus is not just the perfect high priest, he's the permanent high priest. You know, every year, throughout the year, the religious system had to atone for sins in various ways, offerings in various ways. And when Jesus comes along, all that falls away, because he is not just a temporary solution, he's a permanent solution to our very real problem of our alienation from God. In read on in chapter 7, it says, therefore he, Jesus, is able to save completely those who come to God through him. Why? Because he always lives to intercede for them, for us. In verse 9 and 10 of chapter 5, we read, he became the source of eternal, everlasting salvation, and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Now, I had such a temptation to not speak about Melchizedek, because it's really, it's a little bit of a rabbit trail. But he spends the next like 2-3 chapters really driving home that Jesus is after the order not of Aaron priesthood, but Melchizedek, to the point where he says, you guys should know this. He actually rebukes them, like, you should know this, you should have moved on from this. So, lest you get to heaven one day and a gentleman introduces himself to you as Melchizedek, I've never heard of you, I'm going to fulfill my duty. Today you're going to hear about Melchizedek very briefly and why it connects to Jesus. So, Melchizedek is this very mysterious figure that shows up in Genesis chapter 14. There's a few verses on him. Here's the story. Abram is not yet Abraham. His name hasn't changed, but Abram, his nephew Lot is in a bad space, in a place in the city, and so he goes to rescue him. All these five kings rally against Abram and his people, and Abram, through the hand of God, routs them, gets his nephew back, and then takes all the goods that have been stolen from them and brings them back to where he is. On his way back, Melchizedek meets him, intercepts him. And we are introduced to Melchizedek. He is called the King of Salem, which was Jerusalem at that time. King of Salem means King of Peace. And he's also called the Priest of God Most High. And so he blesses Abraham. And Abraham, in response, gives him a tenth of everything he has. A tithe, if you will. Right? He gives him a tenth of everything he has as a way of worship. And so he's a mysterious figure. This is hundreds of years before the law has shown up, before Moses has shown up, before Aaron has shown up, before any of the religious rituals and systems have shown up. And so that's significant a little bit right there. So some think because he's so mysterious, they don't know his lineage, doesn't tell us anything more about that. They think maybe he was an appearance of Christ, a pre-incarnated appearance of Christ. You could look at it that way, or you could look as he was a real person, but he symbolized something very important. He symbolizes a priesthood, right, that beyond lineage, wasn't of Aaron's descent, and was beyond the law. The law hadn't even been introduced yet. And he also did something very significant that no one else could do, is he combined being a priest and a king. Those offices were always separate in the nation of Israel. And so he points to king and a priest coming together. And we know some of this language of the New Testament talks about how you and I are to be priests and like kings unto God. Well, Jesus shows up and he is the king and he is a priest and he is after the order of Melchizedek, not lineage, not law, but he's after this eternal priesthood. And so Melchizedek is a picture, a signpost of what Jesus was ultimately going to come. So if you continue reading in Hebrews, pull out a commentary next to you, because he's going to do a deep dive into this guy called Melchizedek. So there you have. Maybe that's whipped your appetite. Maybe it's made you a little bit more confusing. Great. Go and do your own Bible study. But that's him. It's really important. And he makes a distinction that Jesus is better. Jesus is better and far better than even the priests of Israel's time. Number three, not only is Jesus a perfect and a permanent high priest, he's a compassionate high priest. One of the reasons why the high priest was chosen from among the people is he had to be able to deal gently with people. He had to know what it was like for them to struggle, because he struggled. He had to know what it was like for them to encounter sin. And so how does Jesus do this if he's sinless? How does Jesus really know what it's like when you and I are tempted or tested? Well, this is also a very, sometimes very confusing thing for people, but Jesus in his humanity experienced temptation and testing like you and I do. He's not detached from his humanness. He was fully human. In fact, you can make the claim that he was the most fully human, because that was what humanity was supposed to be all along, right? Our problem is not being human. Our problem is being sinful human. God never intended our humanness to be something bad. It was supposed to be something glorious. And so you could argue Jesus is the most fully human ever. And so he knows what it's like to feel hungry. He knows what it's like to feel tired. He knows what an eye roll is when he sees his own band of disciples talking about stuff that's just stupid and irrelevant. He's like, oh my gosh, these idiots. He might not have said that. He might have thought that. And so, I mean, in some ways, he kind of did say that. He goes, knuckleheads, like, how long do I have to stay with you? You don't get this. You know, like, God, is this plan A? Do we plan B? No plan B. This is plan A. Oh my goodness, here we go. And so he knows what it's like to be alone. He knows what it's like to feel sadness. He knows what it's like to be rejected from people very close to him. He knows what it's like to be misunderstood by his family. He knows what it's like to experience all those and much more. He knows what it's like to feel tested and tempted to do it not God's way, but your own way. Probably the most dramatic scene of that is in the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus is praying and he's got three of his closest disciples with him. And he says, hey, stand with me. And what are they doing? They're sleeping. So he knows, even in your greatest hour of need, sometimes there's people that you think you want to rely on are not there for him. And he's wrestling. What is he wrestling? God, is there any other way? He knows what's before him. It's the cross. And he knows what all that means. And he's asking a very human-like question. God, is there any other way? You've asked that before. Not only you asked that, you've tried that. God, this way is better. Come with me, bless me on this way. And so Jesus stops short of what you and I often do, is thinking and acting upon our way is better. As he comes to a place of like, and it says he learned obedience. He learned obedience, not that he was disobeyed, but he learned obedience. He learned what it was to say, I feel tested to do it another way. But not my will be done, your will be done. And that's his prayer of submission in that moment. And so he sympathizes. He knows what it's like when you and I feel tested, tempted, and tried. C.S. Lewis, it's a long quote, but I want to read it. He, I think, sums it up well and maybe says it in a different way that'll make a little more sense to you. He says, no man or woman knows how bad he is till he has tried very hard to be good. A silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. After all, you find out the strength of the German army by fighting against it. You can tell when he was writing this. Not by giving in. You find out the strength of a wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down. A man or woman who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside us until we try to fight it. And Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. Jesus knows what it's like to be face to face with all the demonic testing and temptation that humanity we could ever sum up. He knows what that feels like. And so that isn't just good theology to understand, but that is deeply personal for you and I, because we are weak and in need, and he can meet us in our weakness and our need. And so because of that, the author of Hebrews says, because of that, it's so important that you understand that because of that, he can help you in your need. Jesus helps us in our need because he was tempted in every way. Our modern expressions of sin are different. Was Jesus tempted to lie on his tax return? No. So how could he know what that temptation is? Because greed, there's nothing new under the sun. The essence of sin is still the same. Was Jesus tempted to go on his smartphone and doom scroll or unlock pornography? No, because the smartphone hadn't been. But lust is still the same. The essence of it is still the same. And so, yes, our modern expressions of sin, our modern ways of falling into temptation might be unique, but there is nothing new under the sun. And so the essence of sin remains the same. He knows human struggle firsthand. And now, as our risen and ascended Lord, he represents us. before the Father. And just like that high priest, on the Day of Atonement would go in to the Holy of Holies, Jesus, through his death and his resurrection and then his ascension to heaven is effectively like that. It's going into the Holy of Holies, God's space, heaven, whatever you want to call it. But not just temporary, everlasting, he's there. He represents us. Jesus, as a human being in his exalted state, is there representing you and I, interceding on our behalf continually, giving us access continually to the most holy presence of God ever. Now, if you were a Jewish person, this would be mind-blowing, because you had to be born in out of the lineage of Aaron. You had to be chosen out amongst the priests. You were the one person who could get to go into that space one day a year. And now Jesus is saying that access is open to any and everyone whenever. And so this is a big deal. In one of the commentaries I was reading, the author, he says it like this. He says, rather than one who stands between God and humanity, Jesus takes us to God, ripping away the moral and ritualistic obstacles that prevented our free entrance to his presence. I'm so glad he did that. And then the author ends. The author encourages us with two things, and this is how we're going to end. Because of all this, he says, one, hold firm. He says, hold firm. Testing and trial, it shouldn't surprise us. Wanting to turn back or turn to other things, look to other mediators, look to other priests, other things to mediate or better, some whatever it is our heart or soul is longing for. He says, hold firm. Let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For he who promised is faithful. There's a song we sang. There was a time we sang this song a couple of years ago. It's called King of My Heart by John and Sarah McMillan. And there's a line in the bridge. It says, when the night is holding on to me, God is holding on. And in the context they were talking about, I think just, you know, sometimes when we're gripped with depression or we're gripped with whatever it is that's gripping us, darkness, whatever that darkness is for you particularly, we can hold on to God because we can understand that God is always first holding on to us. Hold firm because God's got you firmly in his grip through Jesus Christ. You can hold on to him because he first has held on to you. This is the better news that Christianity tells us. It's not all these things you got to do to get to God or bridge the gap between you and God. It's like, you can try, and we have tried, and God knows we still try to do all those things. But the gospel and the good news of Jesus is that he did the bridging. He brought God to us. That holy God came amongst an unholy people and was able to dwell amongst us because of the sacrifice of the Son, Jesus Christ. So firstly, hold firm. And secondly, he says, draw near. I think our instinct is to hide from God. You know, when I was a teenager, I hid so much of my life from my parents. And I look back on it differently now, and it led me some very destructive and devastating paths. And it's something I've had to work hard at as a parent, because I don't want my kids to go down that path. That even if you mess up and mess up in a big way, that mom and dad are a safe space, at least to come clean and say, I messed up. Okay, let's see how we can figure this out, walk this out. And so our instinct is like that. Our instinct is to kind of hide, especially when we know we're guilty, especially when we know we've done something that's not really, you know, in our best interest, or we kind of know we've done something wrong or pursuing a path that we know is not necessarily God's path for us. But Hebrews gives us a better news and a better way. Don't hide from God. Draw near. And not just draw near. It says, come honestly. Right? Like, how do we hide any? I can hide stuff from my parents. My kids can hide stuff from me. But how do you hide from an all-knowing God? All right? So cut the facade and just get real and honest with God, because he knows it already. Come honestly. Come confidently. And now this is crazy, because I think sometimes when we come to God, we feel very sheepish, whatever it is. It says come confidently. So I don't know which one is more of a struggle for you, or both were a struggle for you, coming honestly or coming confidently to God. And then as you do that, keep coming. Keep coming. Draw near. Jesus has done all this to render the gap, bridge the gap between us and the divine, to give us access to the most holy God. And we're to call to come near to him. Come honestly. In other words, come as you are. Right? Sometimes we have this idea, like particularly if you've ever tried to invite people to church service who are not churchgoers, they feel like, oh, I don't think I could go there. Well, like, my life is not really, you know, in shape, right? Like, there's this idea we've got to get dressed up for church, like maybe physically, but also in our lives. Oh, I've got to get my life right before I can come to church and God. And I think that is so the opposite of the gospel. It's like, just come with all your filth to Jesus. Come with all your sin. Come with all your shame. Come, like, bring it. He's saying, draw near. Come with all of that. I was the scapegoat. I am the sin offering for it. And so we come, and to come confidently that his grace, that his throne has been changed from a place of distance and judgment. And through Jesus Christ, it is a throne now of relationship and grace, if you choose to trust in Jesus as the way toward God. So come honestly, come confidently, and keep coming. So I don't know which one of those you struggle with. Honestly coming to God, confidently coming to God, or consistently coming to God, or probably all three. But the author of Hebrews says, fix your eyes on Jesus. And because you can fix your eyes on Jesus, you can hold firm when everything in your life feels loose or fragile. Because God's got you. And that you can draw near in your time of need. You can draw near in your time of testing. You can draw near in your time of temptation. Particularly if it's the temptation that Jesus faced in the testing to do it your own way. To do it another way. He knows what's that like, that is like, and can help us in that. So I'm going to invite you to stand. We're going to go back into a song of worship. We're going to pray. And honestly, you don't need another priest, because the one that you need has already found you. And his invitation is to come to me. We looked at that last week. Come to me. And his invitation is to draw near, to hold firm to the faith. And so pray with me today. If that's a struggle for you, pray and confess that. But draw near to the God who sympathizes with whatever you might be going through. And so, Father, we do thank you. Through your Son, Jesus Christ, you have made a way for us to return home. And I pray for every person in this place here today, Lord, the areas that we might still be hiding from you, whatever that might be in our lives, Lord, that we hear the words of a gracious, merciful, and still holy God today, to draw near, to come honestly, to come confidently, not in what we've done, but in what Jesus, you have done, confidently coming to that throne of grace and to find mercy in our time of need. And Lord, may we find that grace, may we find that mercy, and may that grace cleanse us of our guilt, cleanse us of our shame, and empower us to live a different way, to live the way of following you and submitting to you and saying, not my will be done, but your will be done.
You've been listening to a message from Every Nation GTA. Thanks for joining us. For more information, visit our website at everynationgta.org.